America does not have a school shootings issue. It has a gun violence issue.
On episode 8 of the Prevention Matters podcast, I speak with Anthony Petrosino. Dr. Petrosino serves as the director of the WestEd Justice and Prevention Research Center and has more than 35 years of experience in violence prevention, school safety, and prevention science. I ask him about his career studying violence prevention, his experience as an early collaborator with the Campbell Collaborative, how to best prevent youth violence, and his favorite cop movie. All of that and more on this episode of the Prevention Matters podcast.
The National Prevention Science Coalition is the premier professional association dedicated to translating scientific knowledge into effective and sustainable programs and policies to enhance the well-being of children, families, and communities. To find out more about the National Prevention Science Coalition or to become a member, please visit www.npscoalition.org. And now the host of the Prevention Matters podcast, Dr. Robert Lischoff.
Anthony Petrosino serves as the director of the WestEd Justice and Prevention Research Center that focuses on high-quality research to identify solutions that promote positive community and school environments. Dr. Petrosino has more than 35 years of experience conducting research in violence prevention, school safety, justice, and public health, with an emphasis in program evaluation and research synthesis. Welcome to the Prevention Matters podcast, Anthony.
Oh, thank you so much, Robert. It's great to be here.
So let's just start by talking about your background and experience in prevention.
Right. So I've, as you mentioned in your nice intro, I have worked quite a long time as a researcher and evaluator. My background in training and education is in criminal justice. And I've been working for the last, I'd say, 17 years at a firm called WestEd, which is a research contract firm, research and services firm, that has mostly done work in education. And it's kind of gotten me into more education-based types of prevention, and particularly on the school safety front. That's work that I was not doing before I came here, whereas most of my work before I came to WestEd was on larger sort of evidence-based justice and delinquency prevention strategies like Scared Straight, et cetera. My pathway to getting into this work is probably like a lot of folks. I didn't start out, thinking about doing this for a living. I was a person who wanted to be a police officer when I was very young. Kept failing the eye exams. Back then, when I was in my early 20s, the standard for vision was 20/30 or 20/40 uncorrected, and my vision's a lot worse than that. So I couldn't squint my way through those exams. I kept failing those. Ended up doing a couple of other kinds of jobs. Then had an opportunity to go back to grad school, and I said, I'll just get my finish this master's I started in criminal justice and then go on to law school. I had a couple of cousins that were lawyers, and a lot of people were encouraging me to go that route. But when I went back to graduate school, I was a little bit older. Now I was like 25, and I was a bit more mature, and I really loved my reemergence in graduate studies in criminal justice at Rutgers. Great faculty, and I just got involved there at the school, finishing my master's, and went into the doctoral program and kind of launched my career in research from that point on, which was really like the late 80s. And I have to give a big shout out to my mentor at Rutgers. I had a lot of great faculty that I really adored, but my mentor is David Weisbird, who's, still very prominent. He's a very prominent criminologist who teaches at both George Mason and Hebrew University. But back then, he was an assistant professor at Rutgers, and he put me on a couple of his projects, and I didn't really know much about data and research and statistics and all of those things, but he certainly taught me a lot through the process of working on his projects that really did launch my not only my career, but my love for for the work of a researcher.
So when did you begin to focus on violence prevention and school safety issues specifically?
Yeah, so I, you know, it's been kind of an interesting pathway. I guess the start of that kind, like really getting involved in particular in evidence-based policy started for me when I, then after I finished my doctoral studies at Rutgers, I was a postdoc at the Harvard Children's Initiative. So that got me kind of involved in a lot of evaluation stuff, you know, learning about the theory of evaluation and really got to work very closely with Carol Weiss, who unfortunately died in 2013. But Carol was considered the founding mother of program evaluation. And so Carol and I started working together on some stuff, but I learned more about evaluation. And then through that fellowship, I got linked to a fella overseas in England who had started the Cochrane Collaboration for Healthcare. He had helped start it, Sir Ian Chalmers. He was actually knighted for his work, which was building evidence-based resource in medicine and healthcare. And there was a lot of talk about doing the same thing in social and educational interventions. And so I was part of an early group of really founding members that started to develop what's now known as the Campbell Collaboration, which really right. focuses on these different, you know, what works across these different areas. And I became the founding coordinator for the Crime and Justice Group. So that got me kind of launched into doing evidence reviews. Scared Straight was the first one, but there were, you know, many people all around the world that were contributing to these reviews on what works, not only in crime and justice, but then we had, you know, a social welfare group, we had a group in education, and it's morphed into some more groups over the years. And that kind of got me involved in getting more into, you know, assessing the effects of interventions and policy and practice in these particular areas. And the school safety stuff, that really came with WestEd, because as I mentioned, I was doing more in the justice space. I was doing more, of course, with Campbell Collaboration. I was doing that kind of work. When I came to WestEd in 2005, WestEd is a nonprofit that has largely focused on K through 12 education. And that kind of got us into, it got me more into the school safety space. And in particular, you know, Robert, what happened was after Newtown, when we had the massacre at the elementary school at Sandy Hook, that launched a lot of initiatives in President Obama's administration. One of them was called Now is the Time to End Gun Violence. And part of that administration focus was on, you know, what can we do? And a couple of those strategies had to do with school climate and mental health for young people. And then the Congress allocated a sizable amount of money to the National Institute of Justice for school safety research and development studies. You know, before that, and I'm talking about an incredible amount of money, $75 million a year starting in 2014 went exclusively to the study of school. You know, it was really field demonstration projects where they work with school districts to implement and then study these school safety interventions. And they largely were studied with randomized controlled trials with rigorous studies. And this was an unprecedented investment, because you have to think about the National Institute of Justice, their annual budget, it's been pretty stable over the years. And it's really about $60 million a year for everything. And by the way, half of that goes to, or about half of it goes to like forensic stuff like DNA laboratories. So they don't really have a tremendous budget for social science, what we would call social science research. And so to get $75 million on school safety alone was quite an investment. And they got that for 4 years, something in that ballpark. So tremendous investment. And that, of course, having that kind of money available and WestEd being very strong in educational research, it wasn't much of a leap for us to get involved in those school safety rigorous studies. And we were, you know, we were part of quite a few of those. And so that kind of also propelled me into doing more in the school safety arena.
Yeah. And in a lot of your work that you've focused on in terms of violence prevention has been looking at kind of violence prevention, maybe with youth or adolescents. And Programs such as Scared Straight involve organized visits to prison facilities by juvenile delinquents or children at risk for becoming delinquent. And the programs, as I understand it, are designed to deter participants from future offending by providing them kind of a firsthand look at prison life and interacting with adult inmates. Can you tell us, what do we know about the effectiveness of those types of Scared Straight programs?
Right. And so, Robert, that's a really, I think it's an important lesson for us in research. That here, and also for policy, right? This is a program that is very cheap. It doesn't cost much to implement. It has a lot of common sense attractiveness to people. They think, oh yeah, you know, I would be scared not to get involved in crime if I went to a facility and I had to be confronted either in a very aggressive way by people, you know, behind bars, lifers. In the case of the first Scared Straight program at Rahway State Prison in New Jersey, that was lifers who had put that program together. And it was a very aggressive, what, confrontational kind of sessions with young people. And most people see that and they say, gosh, that is scary. I wouldn't get involved. I don't want to end up in prison. But it turns out that in the 9 randomized trials, and that's what we focused on, we collected 9 studies, and they were 9 randomized studies was our criteria for review. And in those 9 studies, when you do your, you know, statistical analysis, it shows that on average, the young people who went through Scared Straight actually did worse on crime outcomes than the young people who got nothing. It was a no treatment control group.
Wow.
And that's been replicated by many other reviewers. We're not the only ones that have found that. But for example, when the University of Maryland folks led by Lawrence Sherman in 1997 did a review of what works, what doesn't, and what's promising for Janet Reno and the Attorney General. It's a very legendary report. It's called the Maryland Report by many folks, or the Sherman Report by Larry being the first author. And they also said, you know, and they list the programs that don't work. They have Scared Straight in there. When the Surgeon General for the United States, and I think it was back in 2000, early 2000s, also issued a report on what works in terms of preventing youth violence. He also, I think it was David Satcher, he also had, and his team had a list of programs that, you know, we shouldn't use. These are programs that are either don't work or they're actually toxic. And in there at the top of the list, or at the very near the top, was Scared Straight. For a long time, I would get probably one email or phone call per month from somebody trying to get a young person they knew into that program. And so I'd have to go through and say, look, I know you got my name, but here's why you got it. And I can't in good conscience recommend this program.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that despite, you know, extensive evidence that doesn't support the effectiveness of, you know, Scared Straight in specific, but even more fear-based prevention programs don't work? Why do you think there's still continued support and use of them out in the community?
Yeah, I've been racking my brain with that a little bit myself. Is there a communication message? Are we getting the message out there? You know, in the same way that other messages are transmitted, you know, is research communicated the same way? I think our findings are out there quite a bit, but I don't know if they're circulating across the non-scientific community. I mean, I think some policy and foundation people have come across our review, and certainly researchers know it and cite it as well as these other reviews. I don't want to make it sound like we're the only ones who've done that. But I don't know if it transmits to the general folks as much.
Another issue that I think we face in prevention is that, and you alluded to this, is that perhaps we're not communicating what we need to communicate to influence social policy in a way or in a channel that, you know, the everyday person can understand. You know, we're going to these academic conferences and literally we're preaching to the choir, and then we publish in these esoteric, you know, publications, these peer-reviewed journal articles that only a handful of people and our students are required to read.
Right.
What do you think, or maybe, you know, what does WestEd do? What does your group do to try to bridge that divide?
Yeah, really, Really, I love that question. It reminds me, you know, and I don't know how that would work. I do know we've always had, we used to call them research champions, and man, maybe they were the early forerunner of influencers. But I'll give you a great story in the educational sector, which is, you know, there was a very famous randomized trial of class size that was done years ago. Achilles and I'm blanking on the second author is a very famous researcher at Buffalo, professor there. But it was a, you know, very famous study that shows and just showed in Tennessee that, you know, reducing class size, I think from 25 to 15 on average, really improved reading scores for, you know, young people in third grade. And it was a famous study at the time, but didn't really impact policy the way you would have thought, because I think it was done in the 80s. And then a famous statistician that I was very fortunate to work as a postdoc for, he was my assigned mentor when I was a postdoc at Harvard, was Frederick Mostower. Now, Fred was, you know, a very influential statistician in the 20th century. Well, he wrote an article in a Foundation magazine. It was called something about children today, or the future of children, which is was a very famous magazine in the 90s that the Packard Foundation, David and Lucille Packard Foundation, had done. And he wrote an article that highlighted the findings from that experiment. It turns out, because Fred wrote about it and he was sort of championing, hey, this is a big randomized trial, it found these very important effects, and we ought to be following the results of that randomized trial. Somebody in the Clinton administration got a hold of that article that Fred did in Future of Children, and was able to convince the Clinton administration, President Clinton and his team, and they embarked on that policy that would basically put 100,000 new teachers in schools as a way of trying to reduce the class sizes around America. And I don't follow education research as closely, or educational policy. I don't know if it worked. I don't know if the policy was implemented the way they intended, but it shows the wonderful effects of having a champion.
Yeah, I think that's something that's missing from our field. And I think when we have collaborative relationships where you have maybe an evaluation of some type of prevention or social program going on, and you tie into that, you know, buy-in from the community and collaboration from community members in conducting that research, and then also have, you know, a policy maker or a policy sponsor that says, hey, we're going to intentionally and purposely use this information, whatever the information says,
right?
But we come up with a plan that says, this is how we're going to use this information. You know, you mentioned the Campbell Collaborative, you know, how those synthesis are really a good way that policymakers can come and say, okay, what do we know about, you know, class size, or what do we know about, you know, school-based law enforcement officers? And they can get that information, because they're not going to read the peer reviewed journal article. They need 300 right. words or less. I think that also ties into kind of what practitioners are doing. So practitioners aren't necessarily reading the journal articles, but when you have organizations like, you know, back several years ago, it's no longer around, but the What Works Clearinghouse that was funded by the United States government, where people could go and say, hey, I'm interested in, you know, violence prevention with this population, let's say grade school kids, you know, an in-class, you know, primary prevention program, you know, which ones work and, you know, why do they work? Or even now, the University of Colorado has taken over the blueprints, where yes. you know, people can go there and they can say, hey, listen, I'm interested in, you know, school climate issues and academic achievement, or I'm interested in HIV and AIDS prevention with college students, you know, which programs work, which programs don't work. And all of that information is laid out in a very nice, easy to use way. So this leads me to my next question. What do people get wrong? What do policymakers get wrong about school violence and the prevention of school violence?
Yeah, and I mean, this front and center, right, is I think we both talked about our children. And, you know, as a parent, you think about, although my kids now are grown beyond school. But I do remember when Columbine happened and our daughter was in high school. And everybody was on edge the next day. And I remember they parked police cars at every entrance. Not that they could have done anything. You could have still walked in there with a backpack with a weapon. They weren't checking anybody, but it was a show of force. Hey, don't be afraid. You know, we're here. And so, you know, it's front and center on a lot of folks' mind. I think one thing that we've tried to do at WestEd is provide some balance and perspective to the issue. The thing to think about in terms of, you know, I'll talk about the most extreme violence, which are the shootings, which are, you know, devastating. The ripple effects, the pain and suffering that is caused and continues, you know, generation after generation of all the pain and misery of not only losing, you know, whether it's children and staff, but the people who witnessed it, the first responders. You know, I don't want to minimize that, but just putting it in balance and perspective is that, and you know these data, Robert, from the CDC, they have this school-associated deaths, which education and CDC started about 25 years ago. Every year you look at those data, when you look at school-age children and how and where they are victims of homicide, it regardless of the massacres, you know, at Newtown or Columbine or, God forbid, the one we just had in Uvalde, every year it's 1-3% of children under the age of 18 and younger, school-age children, who are, when they're murdered only 1-3% in school, which is still, you know, one is too many. We know that. I'm saying that right off the bat. But 97-99% without fail, it's outside of the school. So it tells, what do those data tell me? It tells me if we really care about kids and their safety, we have to be doing a lot more and not just about the school, because most children, when they are victims of homicide, it's outside of school. So we really have to do something about the, you know, the sort of the entire environment. It also tells me, when I think of those data, that, you know, if we think about, okay, since, I guess, 2019, 2020, I think we're up to 75% of homicides. I'm not sure about school-age children, but I think overall homicides, 75% are now with a firearm. And I'm a big believer in what Dewey Cornell is, a famous researcher, prevention research, school-based prevention and school violence researcher at University of Virginia. He says America does not have a school shootings issue. It has a gun violence issue, which schools are one of many places, unfortunately, that America kind of leads the world. You know, we lead the world in mass shootings. We lead the world in school shootings and many, just about any other location where there are shootings that are happening. And so that's all, you know, that tells you a lot, too. It also says in terms of prevention, it's going to be very tough if you have an environment in which shootings are happening, you know, outside of school. Young people are being killed on the street or they're being killed in other places. Firearms are prevalent. It's going to be very hard to stop that in a school environment. I'm not saying there's nothing we can do. There's obviously things that can be done. But when people are thinking about prevention of school shootings, they're saying, and even mass shootings in general, they're thinking about, we want zero. And zero is going to be hard to get to in a society in which we have this level of gun violence, and both in and out, you know, out, certainly outside of schools. And now in the school, there are some things we can do. Now, Dewey Cornell has done one of the studies that show about threat assessment being a potential, in his study in Virginia, showed it to be effective in terms of, you know, can we assemble a threat assessment team? Can that assessment team kind of go through a triaging process? And a review process as a threat becomes apparent. And by threat, it doesn't have to be a shooting. It could be a student who's expressed an intention to harm themselves, or that they're going to go to school and punch a kid. I mean, that's still a threat. But what do you do about it once you get that information, whether it's a parent or another student, or it comes in through if somebody's monitoring social media, or it comes in whatever way it comes into the school's kind of information system, it now knows that this is this threat has been expressed or has emerged somewhere. What do you do about it? How do you act on it? How do you, you know, get the intervene and if intervention is necessary? And a threat assessment is one strategy in which to do that. So you have a trained multidisciplinary threat assessment team that can kind of marshal themselves to assess and then take action. And the point should be care, care for the, if it, let's say it's a student, how do we get that student the services they need, not looking to, you know, punish, expel, get law enforcement involved, unless it's aggravated to that point where we need to get, you know, we need to have a justice system response. But so threat assessment is one strategy in which, at least in the Virginia study, showed some positive impacts. And again, that's not to minimize it. It could go wrong, right? Any intervention is potentially could have some negative impacts if it's implemented poorly, if it's biased and inequitable in some way. That there's been criticisms of that threat assessment process. But I think if it's implemented well, that's a strategy that at least you're not powerless. You're not waiting for something to happen. You're taking an organized, hopefully an informed and evidence-informed approach to addressing that school safety threat.
Other approaches have been things like, well, we want to prevent violence from occurring. And so what we're going to do is place a law enforcement officer, a deputy sheriff, mm-hmm. in the school. Here in California, we call them school resource officers.
Right.
But it seems to me that police officers are not involved in primary prevention. Mm-hmm. They're responding to a crime or violent acts that occur. So is it a mismatch by having police officers in schools as a primary prevention mm-hmm. strategy? Should we be doing, instead of doing that, should we be having teaching social skills in elementary school? So, you know, how do you deal with negative emotions? How do you deal with anger? You know, what are resources in the community you can go to get help? Or is just having law enforcement officers in the schools the right way to go to prevent school-based violence?
Yeah, well, I think the evidence is coming out more and more that, I mean, it's very, just going to the school policing thing, a colleague of mine at WestEd, Joe McKenna, who is one of our school safety experts at WestEd, and myself, we were asked by the National Institute of Justice to do a report for them to Congress, which was basically a congressionally mandated report on school policing. And so we convened some listening sessions. We also did a review of the evidence. Now, from the review of the evidence, it's not that great for the impacts of school policing. The studies are all over the map. There are some positive effects, but overall, there seems to be no difference. We're now moving ahead, and we should hopefully have published soon a Campbell collaboration review, which looks at the impact of school policing on, sort of crime and other outcomes at the school. There's no difference there. Learning outcomes, does it make schools safer? Therefore, kids learn more. There's no difference there. The only impact that we found that was statistically significant across 32 studies was that schools with school policing have more referrals for exclusionary discipline, more out-of-school suspensions, more expulsions, et cetera. And so, you know, that evidence alone would tell us, okay, if we're really looking for an effective strategy, if we want to go this route, we need more innovative approaches, because just putting a police officer there may not be the way to go, at least from the data we're seeing.
So we're at the point in the podcast where I like to do a lightning round with folks. These are more lighthearted, fun questions. And so I'll give you a question and you tell us what pops into your head first. Are you ready?
Okay.
What one word would friends or colleagues use to describe you?
Oh, wow. I think the one I hear the most is nice.
If you had to give someone a book you've read, which book would it be?
Because Carol Weiss has been on my mind, I think about her book from 1972. It was considered the Bible of program evaluation. I think it had a title called Evaluation. It was a little green book. It was about, I don't know, it was less than 100 pages, Robert, but I remember so many people in government were carrying that book around because it was such an easy book to read and understand about evaluating programs and policies.
What's your favorite movie that involves police officers?
Well, I I love Serpico. It was one of the first movies I, you know, it's obviously 1973. It was one of the first movies I saw with the police. And I really enjoyed that movie and the courage that he had to stand up to the corruption in the New York City Police Department at that time.
And the last question I have for you is this. What are you most proud of?
Most proud of my family. You know, I was so blessed to be, you know, my wife. We've been married a long time. We're going on 33 years, but we've known each other for probably 35 or 36 years now. And then we have two beautiful children. Our daughter's a pediatrician in Virginia Beach. Our son's in the U.S. Army. He's serving as a recruiter right now in Southern California. So I'm most proud of that.
Okay, well, that's all that I have for you. I appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Oh, it was great. Thank you so much, Robert. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed the conversation.
The Prevention Matters podcast is the official podcast of the National Prevention Science Coalition. To find out more about the National Prevention Science Coalition or to become a member, please visit www.npscoalition.org. If you'd like to hear more episodes, please click on the subscribe button.